Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Blog Talk Radio. Jillian, good morning. How are you? I should say good afternoon. It's what, 2 o'clock your time? Can you hear me? Jillian, can you hear me? Okay, can you hear me? Hey, Jillian? Can you hear me? Let's see. 1, 2, 3. Jillian, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, loud and clear?
Loud and clear. Yes, okay. Thank you.
How was your day? How was your day?
Beautiful. It's a beautiful Montana day today. The sun's shining and the lilies are just coming into bloom in the garden. So it's a lovely day.
Wow. And you've been outside already?
Yes, I've been outside most of the morning.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for being here with us. What I wanted to do was just go over some 1, 2, 3s in terms of our religious beliefs. Look, I'm looking at the Bible. And it talks about the Garden of Gethsemane, talks about the Garden of Eden. It talks about Adam was created in the Garden and Eve was created from his rib, da-da-da-da. But you have a different story in terms of looking at what Zach Rosichin has said. The Anunnaki created us and made us, and here we are, and give us a story. And you wrote the book, The Return of the Anunnaki. Could you just briefly talk about that? And then I'm going to ask some other specific questions.
Well, I think the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, is telling a story or a series of stories. And the book of Genesis begins with the story of creation, which is actually condensed version of the Sumerian Enuma Elish, which was the story of the creation by the Anunnaki before the flood, brought through into the Sumerian oral tradition, passed down into biblical times, and goes into the Bible as a very condensed version in the book of Genesis. And then you get on to the creation of the Adam and the Eve. The Adam, meaning the word Adam is actually an Anunnaki word, which means man, in general, man or earth man. And so the Anunnaki came tens, hundreds of thousands of years prior to the time of that particular story in the Bible and began genetic engineering on the living species on planet Earth and eventually altered one of the hominid species and produced, after about 40, 50,000 years of trial and error, produced what we know today as modern man, Homo sapiens. And then throughout the history of the Sumerian people, these were the years after the flood when the Anunnaki perfected modern man, created multiple copies, a whole civilization, and developed the Sumerian civilization. But how do you develop a civilization? Well, by teaching the people agriculture primarily in all its forms, and then things like woodworking, metalworking, all the trade skills that we think about that create a community environment and a community life among people, as opposed to just a very primitive tribal living. You start to create cities and multiple people living in them with organization and management. And this continued on for many, many years until about 6,000 years ago, when it was decided by the Anunnaki that they were no longer going to stay on the planet and rule directly Homo sapiens, but they were going to put a particular man, Adapa, who they had trained for the job, in charge, make him king, as it were, give him rulership or kingship over the humans on the planet at that time. and leave him in charge. And that takes you right through the biblical story of Adam and Eve, of the gods, the Elohim, the plural lords, who were walking in the garden, of Jehovah and Yahweh, who were having discussions about how they were going to manage things. These are all the Anunnaki lords that were arranging everything, and then you come to the point in time when they hand it over and leave the planet themselves, leaving humans in charge. And then from then on, you get the Bible stories of what happened to those people, you know, the Book of Kings and so on, the famous ones, you know, Solomon and David, and these were all the appointed kings, and they were appointed, and they were appointed by the priest, the chief priest or prophet of the time, who was in fact a descendant through appointment of the original Adapa, who originally was appointed by the Anunnaki before they left. So does that bring you up to date a little bit?
It does. And let me take 2 minutes and play this for you, because that corresponds with what this gentleman is saying.
The most ancient civilization known by the man, the Sumerian, tell us in their ancient writings about the existence of beings out of this world, coming from the stars. The ancient Sumeria had its heydays between 3000 and 2000 BC, according to the translations of the Sumerian tablets made by Zechariah Sitchin, writer, a great ancient languages polyglot. He tells us that in the ancient Sumeria, there existed and visited this world some beings called Anunnaki, which means the ones who come to the earth from the sky. In these translations that Zechariah Sitchin made, he explains that these gods came from the stars and genetically modified Homo erectus to create Homo sapiens. That means to create us. What Zechariah Sitchin does not tell us is that these beings, Anunnaki, had reptile form with a humanoid body full of scales. How do we know this? Simple. The Sumerian left us several clues about these beings, thousands of representations that can be found in the paintings traced in their caves, stone statuettes made at image and likeness to their gods. The Sumerian were the first to talk about these Anunnaki. But they were not the only ones who talked about these beings, these gods. In Mexico, thousands of kilometers away from the Sumerian culture, and with an abysmal difference in time, 3,000 years later, the ancient Mayas worshipped a god called Quetzalcoatl, the famous feathered serpent. He was one of the most famous among their long collection of the gods they worshipped, and which, according to them, came from the stars. The same definition the Sumerian gave to these beings. The words that build up the name of Quetzalcoatl are Quetzal, that means feather, and Coatl, that means serpent. For the Maya culture and other folks, like the Nahuatl, the brother of Quetzalcoatl was Tezcatlipoca, which means black smoking mirror. Tetzcal, mirror. Litic, black. Poctil, smoke. According to the Toltecs, these gods were rivals, the same as the gods Enki and Enlil of Sumerian culture, who at the beginning were brothers and then became rivals. A coincidence, a big coincidence between both cultures, greatly separated by time and distance. Two supreme gods from both Mesoamerican civilizations. Resuming Toltec civilization, there existed a god called Gucamatz, who was described as a wisdom serpent, the one who passed the knowledge to humankind. Its Maya counterpart is believed to be Quetzalcoatl, and in Yucatan, this god was called Kukulcan. Is it that Gucamatz, Quetzalcoatl, and Kukulcan were the same god, Anunnaki, Enki, who transmitted his knowledge to the Sumerian? Another civilization that also had these reptilian gods was the Inca civilization. They worshipped a god called Yukakari, to whom they called the god of the underground treasures, This god was represented as a huge reptile with deer head, and in his tail, he wore little gold chains. Urkagari was considered to as the divinity of what was underground. The same name recalls to a Sumerian city called Ur. The name of Urkagari starts with Ur. Many natives in the surroundings pronounce this god's name as Urkagari. Another interesting coincidence. In North America, the Hopi tribe, who was located in Arizona, state that their ancestors were visited by beings who moved in big flying shields and that also mastered the art of chopping and transporting huge stone blocks, the same as the ability to build enormous and long tunnels and buildings underground. Hopi tribe calls Sheti to a reptilian race that lives underground and which they call the Serpent Brothers. Same as the Inca civilization. The Hopi tell us that these beings lived under the ground. Urkagari lived underground. And the coincidences go on and on in all these civilizations, in spite of the fact of being separated by gigantic amounts of time and kilometers.
Now, what did she say was just off in terms of how you understand things?
Well, I can only speak for myself, and I haven't done the research that she's done. And it is true that when we went to South America, David was known as Quetzalcoatl because the serpent represented wisdom to all the ancient cultures, a serpent. And to this day, it represents wisdom, being knowledge, mostly to do with, in the ancient times, with healing things, with natural knowledge, you know, the knowledge of nature and things, and therefore associated as it is today with the caduceus and the medical profession, right? So serpents have, even in the Native American tradition, the serpent represents wisdom. It's always represented wisdom. Now, this person is saying, as far as I could understand, that all these gods from Sumerian times were recognized as reptilian gods, right? And that they had some kind of serpent heads and scales all over them. Well, I can only speak for myself. I cannot speak for anybody else. And all I know is that I'm Anunnaki. My history is Anunnaki. It has been for hundreds of thousands of years since they took me in and adopted me. I have been reborn into their culture, their lives, their tribe, if you like. It's been my history for at least the last, well, since Atlantis. Since Atlantis, for sure, I have memory of myself as allied or being one of the Anuna. And the Anuna that I know have no scales on them and are definitely not reptilian. And I don't think that the women who Enki found fair and married, and Marduk, who had an earth family, I don't think the women would have been very happy with them having reptilian beings as their partners. And this book of Noah in the Bible says that Noah is the son of one of the gods, and we're speaking about gods, small g's, of course, not big g, small g gods, that Noah was half god, and that Gilgamesh's mother was a goddess. And yet neither Noah nor Gilgamesh nor any of the others whose histories are well recorded have any sign whatsoever of inheriting any reptilian or non-human traits. So for my money, I think that is a series of conclusions that have put two and two together and made something other than four out of it, that they have combined pieces of data in ways that are mistaken. And I think coincidence in this case is probably an appropriate word, because I certainly don't think it's fact. But that's just my opinion.
Okay, yep. I just wanted to see, okay. But when Zachariah Sitchin's put together that history of the Anunnaki coming here from, what was that planet? Nibiru?
They call it Nibiru, yes. It's pronounced Nidra. It's correctly pronounced Nidra, but they call it Nibiru.
Oh, I see. Nidra, yeah. Okay. So when they came here to kind of this, what was here at that point, if I may, in terms of your history?
Well, here was planet Earth, Neanderthal man, Cro-Magnon man. You mean at the time we came back to do the engineering? Prior to that, if you go back far enough, you get the time of the dinosaurs, right? Estimated to be, 150 million years ago, whenever it was. The tail end of the time of the dinosaurs, right, towards the end of their history, because the dinosaurs were on the planet a very, very long time, towards the tail end of their history, that was the time of Atlantis and Lemuria. They were simultaneous overlapping periods of history on this planet, the Lemurian development and the Atlantean development. And there you had a very high civilization on this planet, which was completely destroyed. It was, you know, what do they call it? An extinction level event occurred, and the planet had to start over. So some hundreds of thousands of years later, then we started over again, and humanity started over again and had evolved to the level of Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal men, Homo erectus, on the planet, right? And it was at that time that the Anunnaki returned. At the time when Atlantis and Lemuria occurred and the explosions occurred, there were also cosmic events that created the asteroid belt around the planet that made it almost impossible to get back to this planet from deep space. And it was hundreds of thousands of years later, before the Anunnaki came back, the Atlantean people and the Lemurians, they were Earth humans then, and they're, if you like, the overlords, the ones who blew up the planet, right, who did all the science stuff. These were the Anunnaki who were on the planet at that time. Well, they came back again several hundred thousand years later when one of them found a way through the asteroid belt. And Sitchin describes this, the way they did it, by basically turning a ship into a giant water cannon and blasting their way through the asteroid belt back down, so they were able to get back down to planet Earth when they wanted to come back to get the gold that they already knew from Atlantean times was here. See, if I say they were here in Atlantis and then several hundred thousand years later they come back and they know that the gold is there, it's like, well, if several hundred thousand years have passed, how can they still know the gold's there? Remember, the Anunnaki or the Anuna are on celestial time. They're counting celestial time, which is 3,600 years for every one of our years, for every one of their years. So even 100,000 years is only 25,000 years to them. In other words, it's a whole different ballgame when it comes to counting time. You can't think time is the same off the planet as it is on the planet. Anywhere in the universe, time varies. Time is extremely variable, and it's dependent primarily on the time it takes for a planet to go around its sun, and also on the magnetic fields that determine the lengths of its days and nights, and a whole component, but primarily how long it takes in its orbit around its sun. Therefore, there is a huge variation in the way time is measured. And although I don't understand it, technically I don't understand it, in my mind I understand the principle of relativity. Even though I couldn't sit down with a chalk and board and explain it to someone, I understand the principle of relativity. And we all know today, because of, you know, the space program, how people in space don't get older as quickly as people on the planet do, that time is different. And so when we talk about hundreds of thousands of years, in cosmic time, it's not the same as time on the planet. It's like it's easy for me when I think in celestial time or time from the planet Nibiru, as I would count it if I were on that planet. It's easy for me to say, yes, I remember 10,000 years. It's nothing to me because it's only the equivalent experience to a person on Earth remembering 3 or 4 years of their history. It's no different. I know it can be confusing, but it's really quite simple. Time is different depending on where you're living.
All right. What books would people turn to understand the history as you have enunciated and the young lady just before you? Sitchin's book. What books that Sitchin has written?
Well, the ones that Sitchin wrote that tell the story of the Anuna coming to this planet are his first three, the War of Gods and Men, and the third one, Something in Heaven. I forget the full title. But the original first three books he read, every other book is an expansion on that theme. So the first three books are key to understanding it. And they're fairly substantial books, several hundred pages each. So if you're not a great reader and you really are interested in the subject but don't want to do all that reading, he did write later on a book called The Cosmic Code, which is only 200 or 300 pages long. It's a small pocketbook, and it's a condensed version, really, of the main points that he uncovered archaeologically and talked about in the first three books. The Cosmic Code is a really good little book for people who don't like to read a lot. If you like to read a lot, then start at the beginning with the 12th planet. The South American part is called Rome's Revisited or something, but Revisited is a key word in the title. And that's all about the South American experience. And that was when Thoth and his brother, in the story the lady was just telling, she talks about the Quetzalcoatl and the dark mirror, right? Well, what she's actually talking about, that's like the Bible is a story to explain something. That is a story to explain something. And what it's talking about is the time when Quetzalcoatl, Ningxida, Enki's second son, and his first son, Marduk, the Black Mirror, had a disagreement in Egypt. They had a falling out. There was a big row about it, a big family row. And the end result was that Marduk took over as Ra, the sun god, and Thoth, the Egyptian god of the moon, was shipped off to South America with his entourage. And it was there, that was about 5,000 years or more ago, but it was there that he became known as Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. That's when he got that name, because he brought the knowledge and the wisdom with him.
Okay, so how do you mesh this with the Bible as it's taught? If you go to the religions of the world, go ahead.
The Bible is a great story. And essentially, if you know how to read the Bible, it's a very informative book. It's actually the history of the genetic altering of the people, right? The story of Adam and Eve. When you tell a story, and Christ did the same thing, how did Christ teach the uneducated, illiterate public of his day? He taught them with parables, with stories, right? And there was always a moral or a teaching in the story. Well, the entire Bible needs to be read in that way. It's because remember that when the Bible was put together, it was not an original book. It was oral storytelling and written work by the scribes who were educated to keep a record of the Jewish people and their faith, right? That's what the Bible is, a history of the Jewish people. Now, who are the Jewish people? The Jewish people are the Sumerian people who were the first group genetically altered by the Anunnaki. And they are their descendants, who we know as the Jewish people. And the Bible is basically their history. Remember, Abraham came from the city of Ur. That lady mentions Ur in her, when she's talking about all the serpent people. I remember Ur. I was living in Ur at the time of the fighting when the Jews were in Babylon and Marduk turned them into an army to invade all his brothers and sisters and take over the planet, which was his intention at that time. And he let off the atomics. And the atomics, he nuked the Sinai, which was the like mission control for all the ships going on and off. And it was like he said, I'll make sure you can't come and go as you please because I'm nuking the headquarters, which he did, right? And the winds changed and they blew all across. Everybody thought that Babylon would be annihilated, but it wasn't. It was blown the other way. And that's how they knew that they had to think again about them condemning Marduk for everything, because the gods clearly favored Marduk because they changed the winds. The winds literally blew the wrong way. And at the time that that happened, I was actually living in Ur, and we all had to jump on our little ships and get the heck out of the way. And we lost thousands of people. Thousands of people died from those radioactive winds. It was a terrible disaster. But that's the place where Abraham came from. And so this is all tied in with the biblical history. Sodom and Gomorrah was one of the cities that got nuked because they were breaking all the rules, you know, and were destroyed in this conflagration. I would say this about the Bible, that it is at least 90%, even after 412 translations, it is probably in its storytelling. The theme of its stories is probably 90 to 95% accurate. What it is not is the word of God, in the sense of God being the capital G, the creator of all. The creator of all did not write the Bible. The Bible, like the Sumerian Enuma Elish, was written by the men and the scribes at the times as a history record of what was going on in those times. It's an ongoing living document that was added to over and over and over again, and no doubt improved upon as each different scribe in different generations wrote it. It was not all written at once. It was written over a long, long period of history. But it does have a very informative piece of information in it, because it gives the projected timeline, which may have come from capital G God. Certainly it could have come from small g God, meaning Jehovah or Yahweh, the gods that were walking about in the Garden of Eden, right? There is a timeline in there for the evolution and experiences of human history. And recently, biblical scholars have put together a series of lectures called Noah, right? They're the flood lectures, or the Noah lectures, and they're in four parts, I believe, and they are on some of those History Channel television programs. And these scholars have used the data in the Bible to map out the timeline. And they started this way back in the 1800s. It began with a researcher back in the 1800s. So they've been going at it for over 200 years. But they have mapped out from the Bible a timeline for human history right up to the time of Revelation, which is the time basically that we're in now. So there is a great deal of valuable and accurate and useful information threaded throughout the Bible. And it's a great guideline for humanity. What it is not is the word of the source, the ultimate creator of the universe, because that's not what he does, or it does, or whatever. The thing is that nobody knows what the source of the universe is. Nobody knows who or what the ultimate creative source is, and therefore certainly nobody can say it, who, she, them actually sat down and wrote a book, because they didn't.
Okay. Now you say that you have come as a clairvoyant forth on this planet for the last,
yes,
say 10,000 years, 20,000 years, 100,000 years?
More than that.
More than that.
A long time.
How many incarnations have you experienced?
As an Earth human, just like everybody else, born and raised on this planet, I've been doing that since I got killed in South America about 4,000 years ago. So for the last 4,000 years, I've been doing that. Prior to that, I came back to this planet about 14,500 years ago and lived from 14,500 years for about 10,500 years as an Anuna on this planet, as a young Anunnaki person on this planet. Prior to that, I had been killed and had to be reborn in a whole slew of history in there, and then I go back before that 400,000 years, which was the first time I came to this planet, and that was to look for the place where we were going to build the science research laboratories in East Africa, and I came off a ship on a day trip, basically a day trip down to the planet to look for a building site.
All right.
And that's about a long time ago.
A long time ago. Okay. So this incarnation, why did you come back again? You keep going back and forth. How many this is really, it's going to blow a lot of people's minds to think in terms of that we, or human beings, have a possibility of coming back again and again and again and again, based on whatever goals and objectives that person or whomever makes that decision. Who makes the decision when we leave here? Can we come back here or go somewhere else in the vastness of the universe? Who makes the decision?
We do, in conjunction with guides, counselors, helpers, all kinds of beings might be involved. And the kind of future when imagine that you're not on this planet. Imagine that you are on the other side of that veil, right? That you are in spirit, if you like, and you're looking down on the planet and you're having a discussion with your counselor, right? And the discussion goes something like this. Your counselor says to you, well, this is what you learned in your last several experiences. Your soul experience, however, is very weak in this area. We think that you need to have this kind of experience in the future. And you say, well, yes, I agree with that. And that's what I would like to learn. That's what I would be willing to do. So yes, please, that's what I'd like. Now, how much option you get for the optimum environment and experience from which you can learn back on the planet depends pretty much on how well you lived the last time. If you wasted all the energy of your life the last time, didn't do anything useful, but it didn't learn anything, didn't make any progression, were neither good nor bad, but just did nothing much with the life, then you will have a fairly average choice of your environment for the next learning opportunity. But if you did extremely well in your previous life and were very useful and productive to your fellow man, then you will get a much better option for the future. if you were really bad in the last life and did a lot of damage to your fellow man and your environment, then you're just going to get the rubbish heap to go back on it and have to make the best of it, because that's all that's available to you. So every life that we have is based essentially on what use we made of the last life and what we need to learn in the next life. And then we are offered an appropriate environment in which to live that life. And there is an interesting little tidbit here that Spirit told me many, many years ago. You remember when there was a lot in the newspapers about cot deaths or SID deaths, you know, sudden infant death.
Yes.
Right. And this is this way back in the 70s or 80s. They were talking about this a lot. And Spirit came in and said to me, when I say Spirit, it's a generic term rather than specifying this guide or this angel or this whatever, you know, this ET, if you like, came and said to me, yes, it's interesting because when these cot deaths occur in the first few months of life, well, that is the option of the soul of that infant, that for the first year of life, when an infant is on the planet, their awareness can allow them to assess their situation, and they know in their awareness why they came, and they can decide whether or not the environment they find themselves in is going to be suitable for them, and whether they actually want to go through with that life that they have committed to. Newborn infants have the choice to leave. And for the first year of their life, apparently, they can recall how to simply stop breathing. Now, the only other people that I've ever heard of who can do this are the Aborigines in Australia. And the old Aborigines, the ones that have stayed true to their culture, I understand, also have this talent. They know how to simply stop breathing. And if you've ever tried to do that, it's impossible. You can't stop breathing because your body automatically makes you take another breath. But apparently, in the first year of life, an infant can, because they have that right to not continue with the life they've committed to for 1 year. Right. And then after the first year, they're here. And of course, in a lot of ancient cultures, where spirit matters were of equal importance with material matters, I'm talking about in really ancient times when the sorceress was the head of the tribe kind of thing, the leader, but everybody paid attention to the spiritual aspects. And in some oriental cultures, they don't name a child, or they used not to name a child, for the first year of life. And it was because they were waiting to see, was this child going to actually choose to stay on the planet or not? So in ancient times, this was well understood, that a new body for a soul has the right to, the soul has the right to not stay for a year. And that's what causes these cot deaths, that those souls are choosing not to stay. That's what I understand.
Okay. All right. There's some people who are born and they live 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and they say, okay, I'm out of here. I've had enough. And they commit suicide. What happens to that soul? What happens to that being?
It depends why they committed suicide. If, for example, let's just say a tragic case, they were born crippled, horribly crippling, suffering from a terrible disease, like muscular dystrophy, terrible disease, never going to be able to function with any degree of comfort, never going to be pain-free, never going to be able to participate in life, and maybe they weren't even very smart, very brainy, and therefore they couldn't even have much of an intellectual life because they weren't clever enough to, really get much out of books or things of that nature. So they're having a pretty miserable time, and they decide that they would rather give it up and have another go, basically. Well, that's fine if that's what they want to do. Remember, we have free will. However, if they are young, healthy people, decide that life owes them a living and it's, they're not getting what they deserve, right? Or they've had a broken romance and they're saying, if I kill myself, you'll feel guilty for the rest of your life and I'll be glad of that. In other words, if they are taking their life for all the wrong reasons, then they're going to have a very unpleasant experience. And the experience for those people, when they get to the other side, it's as if the sensation is as if you're trapped in a barrel of tar, blackness. Sticky blackness that you can't find your way out of, and you will stay trapped in that sticky blackness with nothing, no awareness outside yourself until you come to understand that it was a terrible thing you did and that a lot of people were damaged and hurt by it. And when in their minds they become aware that probably they had not made the best choice in life, right, by killing themselves for all the wrong reasons, then once they recognize that, then they break free, and then their guides and helpers will move in, and basically they will undergo a great deal of psychological retraining. They'll spend a long, long time what you might, like we might think of as a mental hospital, where they're getting sorted out and straightened out and come to understand what they did was wrong and why it was wrong. And that's the worst case scenario I can think of, is when somebody kills themselves for all the wrong reasons. That's the most miserable experience on the other side that one is likely to face.
But people do take themselves out. They say, I've had enough of this existence. I want to. Yeah?
Yeah.
What do they suffer when they do that?
It depends why they do it.
Oh.
It's always motivation, intent. These are the key to everything. It's not what we do so much as why we do it. Why do we do the things that we do? And that is more important in the final examination of our lives. Our intention, our motivation is more important. You know, it's like in the murder stories, they're always looking for the motive. Finding the motive is what enables them to find the murderer, right? So finding the reason why we do the things we do is how we find out the state of our soul, how we find out what is wrong or right with us at soul level. So some things, and that's the punishment. Basically, that is the punishment. Having to think and come to understand why you did the things you did.
Uh-huh.
And the punishment on the other side lasts longer and takes more enduring the longer it takes us to recognize that we did something that was wrong and stop justifying it and recognize our true motives.
But you keep coming in and out of this existence. Why?
Right. Everybody does.
Oh, wait. You said 9 billion people. Let's say 9 billion people today about
right.
that.
Right.
You say they have been here before?
Most of them, I would think, have been on this planet or some other planet. We had this discussion briefly once before.
Just
to recap, right? Right now, the entire universe is realigning itself with the central core for a period which regenerates the actual creation from the source, from the creative source of all, and regenerates it with light, pure light that allows it to repair itself, restructure itself. And in order to do that, it has to align properly. Or throughout the whole universe, every planet is aligning itself into its proper position relative to everything else. Now, when this happens, there is a break in the space-time continuum. And on planet Earth, because we have now on planet Earth a high civilization, it is a desirable place on which to experience the changes that are imminent. And so millions of souls from other planetary systems that have been able and allowed to do so have incarnated on our planet so they could be here and be experiencing a lifetime here through the time of this change. So we don't have 9 billion souls that belong on planet Earth. We probably currently have about 3 or 4 billion that are Earth souls, souls that belong on Earth, souls that began their soul's experiences on planet Earth and who are still attached to planet Earth. And they are about, I'm just guessing, about a third of the souls that are here now. Two-thirds are from other parts of the universe that simply want to be here in this time in history. And when we go through the changes, they will all go home again. And we will be left with the 3 billion approximate, that's just a number I'm pulling out of the air, so to speak. That number will stay on the planet and continue their reincarnational experiences with planet Earth, or maybe a number of them, maybe quite a high number of them, will have evolved to the level where when the change comes, they too will be allowed to leave Earth and go and experience on some other planet somewhere else in the universe, have a new kind of life experience, maybe even a new experience on a more evolved Earth-type planet. We're crowded right now, but we're crowded because of what's happening on the planet, not because all these people belong to and will stay with Earth in the future.
Right.
No, they've come from other places.
Okay. So you are saying to me that there are a number, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, or more different entities in the vastness of the universe who can come and go on this planet. Yes, that's what you're saying to me, right?
Yes, yes.
But in our training and development and our programming, many of the entities here on Earth, people, think that they are the only ones in the universe and there is no one else. Do you understand that thinking?
Well,
yes?
I know people, there are many people who think that way, but they are mistaken. So, you know, and one day they will find out that they're mistaken. It really does. And I just want to say something here to clarify.
Okay.
It's not that all these entities, as you put it, these other people on other planets, can jump in ships and come to Earth. It's that their souls can come to Earth. Now, there is one exception that I know about in the universe, and that's the reptilians. And again, you and I have spoken this before, the reptilian species known as the Draconians do not belong in our universe. They came from a different place and they got here by mistake. So that's very ancient universe history, very, very ancient. Hopefully it will never happen again. But they are not humans. They are reptilians, and they're quite different to humans. But apart from them, every other species that I know about that has a civilization extant on a planet somewhere in our known universe, all those beings, no matter what they look like, they are all human. They might have different looks, different colors, different whatever, but they're all human, not reptilian, but human.
Okay.
And all those humans basically have the same soul material. That's what's key here. So it's their souls that have come to Earth and incarnated as Earth humans for this time in history. In other words, if they were little green men on Mars, they haven't come here as little green men on Mars pretending to be humans. They've left their soul experience as Martians and having a soul experience now as a human, because the soul material of all humans throughout the universe is the same. Do you follow what I'm
telling
you
here? I hear you. But you were saying the reptilians, which are here, they don't belong here. You were saying it was a mistake. I didn't think the universe made mistakes.
Well, of course it makes mistakes.
Oh, okay.
The universe is constantly learning. That everything, it's almost as if everything that is happening, and especially among sentient beings, is that we are having an experience, and when we leave here, we turn over that experience of our lives, that learning, to the central computer, you might say, which feeds that learning back to the source, to the creator. So everything is constantly learning. Everything,
wow.
Including the creator. It's a circle. It's a never-ending spiral of expansion and learning. Expansion is learning, right?
Okay.
Every time we learn something, we expand. We expand our mind. We expand our awareness. We expand our understanding. And so as we, in a body, we are a soul. Remember, we are a soul, a spirit being in a body, in this reality, in this three-dimensional world. And each and every one of us, because we're all the same. Our souls are all the same. We all start out exactly the same. Some progress faster than others. Some are slower than others. Some do well. Some do not so well. But fundamentally, we're all the same. And we are all experiments in the process of learning. And when we die, we take that experiment and we hand over that learning, if you like, to a... It's like, you know, the universal Wikipedia, right? All the knowledge in the universe is out there. And we keep adding to it. And then we also want to learn more. So we come back to another life and we learn more. And the gift to us for being these samples, if you like, these learning tools while we're on this planet, is that we reincarnate and we can have self-awareness. As we go along, we know who we are and we progress. And eventually you get, you know, after you've done it enough times, you get to be like me, and I'm sure millions like me, who have continuing consciousness. We don't lose consciousness from lifetime to lifetime. We continue here, there, back and forth. It's a continuous story of our consciousness. And we develop the skill of remembering it. That's all it is.
Oh, okay. So you keep coming back, and you say many others do the same, incarnate again and again and again.
Everybody does.
Well, I could tell you this is the first time I've been here now. Now, what would you say to that?
I would say that this is the first time that you consciously remember being here. But as this is the end of the cycle, it may be that this is the first time you've incarnated on Earth because you have come from a distant place. It may be, and I would have to look clairvoyantly at you, it may be that you are genuinely a brand newly created soul that's just come into being. And this really is your first soul's experience and that you're having it on planet Earth. So you could be an entirely new being.
Okay,
but
so
the odds are,
as a clairvoyant,
being, yeah,
I'll give you 2 seconds to determine whether I've been here or not before.
Yes, you've been here many times.
Is that right? I don't remember any of that.
Well, no, because you haven't advanced to that level yet. I'm teasing you there. Let me explain this, because people will say, well, how come I, George used to say to me, well, how come I don't remember my past, right? Sometimes we come into a life and we have promised or committed to taking on certain duties and responsibilities that are such that if we could remember our past lives, we would not undertake those duties. So in order to make sure that we do what we came to do, our minds are blanked out so that we don't remember the past. Maybe next time you come around, you will remember it all.
I see.
Just because you don't remember it in this life doesn't mean you didn't remember it in your last life, or that you won't remember it in your next life.
Okay.
So whether you remember or not seems to be, and this is the opinion that I've arrived at after a lifetime of doing this kind of stuff, it seems to me that whether you remember or not is dependent upon two things. One, have you previously had enough learning experience to have arrived at that level of frequency understanding that you are capable of remembering? Or two, in this lifetime, are you intended to not remember for very specific reasons? And I am sure that the reason you don't remember is because of what you agreed to do in this lifetime. And if you want me to say more about it, I can.
Well,
very easily and quickly. Well, what
more.
I want to say for sure is that historically, and it's some time past now, but not that far, maybe a thousand years or so, you have some very powerful, murderous military history in there, in your history, and that left you at soul level after a long time of thinking about it with a great deal of regret and determination that this, as that history relates to this life, that this life would be devoted to educating with words, not with a sword, not beating somebody into submission and making them do what you want, but by trying to use instruction, education, and persuasion to get people to understand things and move the way you thought was the best way. So you are still learning the process of not being manipulative, and that's something you will continue with, I'm sure, in your next lifetime. But because of your intention for this lifetime, you will not remember that history because you would feel too guilty about it, and it would give you too many clues about how it would be like cheating on the exam paper for this lifetime.
Uh-huh.
If we remember too much, it's like cheating.
Okay. Would a person like Hitler or Mussolini or Idi Amin fall in that category?
Those particular people that you are naming, and history has a whole long list of the, you know, Genghis Khan all the way through.
Sure.
These are manifest, these people, their souls are so dark, they are actually manifesting evil. And I honestly don't know what would ultimately happen to them. Are they forgivable? Well, from the source's point of view, everything is forgivable because, and this is not some airy fairy sweetness and light, it's because pure light, when the source of the source of all is light, pure light. And evil cannot exist within light. Therefore, no matter how dark the evil is, if it ever becomes exposed to the pure light of creation, it will in fact be transformed. It cannot continue to exist. The same as dark shadows can't exist when you switch a bright light on them, except they fall behind you, right? That was a silly thing to say, because a bright light creates a shadow, right? And that's true. The brighter the light, the darker the shadow. But that shadow cannot exist when you put the light right on it. The light absorbs it. And so in the ultimate sense of can they ever be forgiven, well, yes, but only when they cease to exist totally and all that's left is the original divine spark of pure light that animated them in the first place. So in that instance, they would no longer exist as entities.
Right, right. But okay, we covered a lot of territory. When we talked about the Jewish people who were created thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, what did they look like?
Well, they look pretty much like they look now, and they look pretty much like the Anunnaki, fairly dark skin, black hair, or red hair. Those were the two predominant characteristics, brown skin and dark hair. Because remember, the original genetic engineering was done with the ova from a woman of Sheba, a daughter of Sheba, East Africa. It was called Sheba in those days, but it was East Africa. And they took the ova from the Homo erectus, which was a very dark-skinned woman, and bred it with their own genes, the Anunnaki, and the Anunnaki themselves are almost, I want to say, a Polynesian, a tanned color. They're not white. They're not white. They're more Polynesian color in the skin tone. Their base is copper, not iron. They're blood base. So they have this tinted skin, right? It's not white. There's no such thing as a white person, and, you know, white people are pinkish, ivory sort of colors. But the Anunnaki are more the color of a Polynesian person, you would expect to have Polynesian coloring. And they mixed with a dark brown person from an Earth human, Homo erectus. So the original would be fairly, pretty much the same as the people of the Middle East are today. You know, you look at any of the Arabic people, and they have nice brown sort of skin, and that's essentially their coloring. But it was a wide range. Humans come in a wide range of colors, and through the centuries, the descendants of the Sumerian people are in a fairly wide range of colors.
Right, right, right. It's a big subject, I tell you that much. Listen, recently, and I guess we could stay on that for about 100,000 hours and people still would be shaking their heads. But anyway, recently there have been some disclosures in terms of the Pentagon. 60 Minutes had a bit, and I just want to introduce this one second.
We have tackled many strange stories on 60 Minutes, but perhaps none like this. It's the story of the U.S. government's grudging acknowledgement of unidentified aerial phenomena, UAP, more commonly known as UFOs. After decades of public denial, the Pentagon now admits there's something out there, and the U.S. Senate wants to know what it is. The Intelligence Committee has ordered the Director of National Intelligence and the Secretary of Defense to deliver a report on the mysterious sightings by next month.
The story will continue in a moment.
Yeah, we are continuing that for the next few minutes. So now it's being said that there are other entities coming to this planet. Now, most people, who have been raised in the Protestant, the Methodist, the Catholic Church, don't see it like that. They don't think other entities are coming to this planet. That some people do now, because in the last 100 years, maybe more, there have been abductions and people are now beginning to remember, like this gentleman here. Just take a minute.
The conscious memories that I had was in the middle of the night, I woke up very conscious, walked over to my living room, saw something in the room, felt the white light, felt the paralysis, and then I fell asleep. Several hours later, I woke up and had these intense emotions associated with the experience that just I couldn't fathom. Like, why was I so scared? Why was I terrified? What was...
You had a bad dream.
That's what I thought. That's what I wanted to believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to believe for years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what most people want to believe.
But now, people are coming to the fore, like in communion, like Betty and Barney Hill, all those stories, Interrupted Journey, are saying that they have been abducted by the Greys, the Reptilians, the Nordics, whomever, the Palladians. People are being abducted. Why? Can we talk about that a bit here in the next few minutes?
Sure. Yes, certainly we can. First thing I'd like to say is that Dr. Michael Sala's books on Antarctica really, really fill you in a very well-documented way about what the governments of the world, especially the U.S. Navy and U.S. Army, have been up to interacting in an interplanetary program with extraterrestrials ever since at least World War II, and that we have a couple of space fleets out there, one belonging to the Navy, one belonging to the Army, and that they're doing amazing things out in space and have been doing for a long time. So there is plenty of true documentary evidence. Now, what comes out on things like 60 Minutes or any other mainstream television program is going to be a mouthpiece for what the government wants you to know. And I think you know that I don't even have television. So I have my little Roku that lets me watch a few movies and Agatha Christie stories, and that's about it. Because I know that everything that comes out from mainstream media is simply serving as mouthbox for the government, and that it's going to be more lies. Remember when they came out with Blue Book, which was the big disclosure that I, you know, told you all about the truth of the UFOs. Well, now they're going to do it again. Now they're coming out with another committee and another report about the, what do they call them now? The APs, right? The UFO things.
UAPs,
they have a new UAPs, right? So they're just going to put another report out. The odds are that they're not going to tell you any more of the truth than they did before. However, I am under the impression myself, see, just me, from information which I have received, that we can expect an event in August of this year, this less a month away, 2 months, you know, 6 weeks away, events which will affect the whole planet and which will be pretty amazing. And I have a strong feeling that this is going to be a real extraterrestrial disclosure, meaning they're going to present themselves on the planet, that we're going to see it in real time, in a real way that is undeniable, that nobody can deny, and that nothing about it can thereafter be hidden, that the truth has to come out.
Right.
So if you want a quick preview of what's really going on, read Dr. Michael Sala's books or go to his website. I believe he has a website, XO something. XO,
well,
I have a book here,
Antarctica's Hidden History by Dr. Michael Sala.
Right.
That's one. And
yeah.
Just to take a minute or two, listen to this.
All the resources and manpower of the U.S. military industrial complex were hence made available for a significant expansion of the German space program, whereby it could become an interplanetary colonial power capable of deploying significant military resources outside of our solar system in support of their extraterrestrial allies. In addition to the Antarctica revelations of William Tompkins, we also have the testimony of Corey Good, who says he served in the U.S. Navy's secret space program, Solar Warden. His claims of serving in Solar Warden and having extensive contact with multiple groups of extraterrestrials were extensively examined in the first volume of this Secret Space Program series. The connection of the pre-Adamites to different historical epochs in our solar system and the role of Antarctica as a refuge for escaping Martians and the inhabitants of a former super-Earth from the asteroid belt is laid out and scrutinized in Chapter 13. The connection between Antarctica and the fallen angels described in the Book of Enoch ensues and is analyzed in Chapter 14. It will be shown how this apocryphal book points to Antarctica as the location of their imprisonment. Most incredible is Good's claim that some of these pre-Adamites are still alive in stasis chambers and that their bloodline descendants want to not only awaken them, but also restore them to their previous positions of authority. If left undisturbed, this nexus of domination and slavery will spread like a virus over the rest of the planet with predictable results. It's up to all that cherish human freedom and creativity to rise up, end this vile practice, and expose the global elite that secretly enable it. Only full disclosure of Antarctica's suppressed history and its current events will ensure that all humanity benefits from the advanced technologies that have been secretly developed and deployed there. Disclosure will furthermore help prepare humanity for major geological events that lie ahead, as West Antarctica's ice shelves continue to melt due to increased volcanic activity. A global transformation awaits us if we have the courage to embrace the truth about what was and is occurring now in Antarctica.
Could you take a minute just to talk about that whole scenario that's happening today?
I would like to say that whoever that was speaking, I totally agree with just about everything he said. I mean, he's absolutely on the ball, especially about all the underwater activity of the volcanoes in Antarctica that are melting the ice shelves and disclosing more and more things. I think I said to you once before, a long time ago, that the time would come when they uncovered great cities under the ice in Antarctica, because I remember Antarctica when it didn't have ice on, and there are several, four or five great cities under that were built there. So that's an interesting time to come. I thought that somewhere in that young man's speech, I was not quite sure what he was saying about the Adamites and the slavery that was coming to the planet. I thought that somewhere there was a bit of muddled thinking. It was not a direct line of thought that I could follow anyway. So maybe I missed something, or maybe he said something else further on. But in general, I agreed with him in almost everything he was saying. And I'll say it once again, Michael Sellers, he is actually quoting from Michael Sellers' books there. And those books are some of the best I've read in the last 20 years for bringing you up to date in what's really happening. And you remember Eisenhower, I believe it was, at the end of World War II, before he left office, he made the statement that the thing we needed to be afraid of was the military-industrial complex. And I would add to that today the military-industrial pharmaceutical complex, because it's through the pharmaceuticals and the biologicals that they're making their final grip on humanity. You know, we tend to forget or not know all our history, but one of the popes quite recently, not this one, but before him, Pope John Paul, at the time, if you look up his original name, you will find that he was the supplier, his company was the supplier of the drugs that killed all the Jews in the concentration camps during World War II. During the Holocaust, they were killed with that xyloton, as it called, and it was produced by the company owned by the Pope. It wasn't the Pope then. Right, but it was his family business, had been for years, this biochemical company. And now you can look to the west, you've got the popes are still in Rome and still going down to Antarctica, where the Germans are, right, and the Fourth Reich. Now you can look across this side and look at Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci is the modern leader of the one that's producing the poisons that is destroying humanity, because he's the one who involved with, approved, and was totally, totally profiteering from the so-called vaccinations to cure COVID, which of course have not cured COVID. They've simply made people more susceptible to other diseases by destroying their immune systems, which the medical profession acknowledges today, and in fact, which Pfizer is currently being sued for. So these people, these evil people, have not changed. They have just become more powerful and had more control over the population of the world. And they are running rampant under Antarctica. And really and truly, we can say that, yes, the Fourth Reich, Hitler's was the Third Reich. The Fourth Reich is existing today, and it's our military-industrial complex, and adding in pharmaceutical associations here in the West, predominantly in America. And most interestingly enough, to bring it into really modern history, the majority, they have research laboratories for the bad things that they use to control people, whether it's chemtrails, chem spraying, or jabs for COVID, or whatever it is they use. They have laboratories for these essentially weaponized bugs that they use in various ways to control people. They have them scattered all over the world. Where I live here in Montana, we have one level 4 research lab, and they're the level 4s are the really bad ones where they weaponize bugs. But the vast majority of them in the world, guess where they are? 2/3 of them are in the Ukraine. And this is why Putin was bombing the heck out of the Ukraine to destroy all their research laboratories where they are producing weaponized bacteria. This is what they were doing in those laboratories. And the heaviest investors were the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation. You follow the money. That's where their money's invested.
Well, a lot of people don't. That's good. Yeah. I just wanted to touch upon this. You say an Eisenhower was warning
President
us against.
President Eisenhower.
Right.
Yes.
He did indeed.
His last words he did when he left office, he warned against the danger of the military-industrial complex taking control.
I don't know who it was who said it.
I don't think it was Eisenhower. It might have been, who at the same time, in the same period of history, said Hitler, they made the statement, Hitler lost the battle, but he won the war.
Okay, all right. So just quickly.
I think that was General Patton.
Okay,
said that,
all
but
right.
I could be wrong on that. I'm not sure.
All right. So Hitler didn't die in the bunkers in Germany in 1945. He escaped to Argentina, and he had his people take over Antarctica, where they are now, with all the bases and all the technology, and thousands upon tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that he took with him to work as slaves in Antarctica to help build that. But a lot of people don't understand that, but Michael Sulla addresses that in the book Antarctica's Hidden History. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
Eisenhower. Now, it is said, I'm coming to cut this quickly. Eisenhower did meet with the aliens back in 1954 at Holloman Air Force Base.
He did. Area 51.
Okay. And then what decisions did he come to in 1954 about the aliens abducting people in exchange for whatever? What was that? What decisions did he make?
I don't know. As far as I can understand it, and from what is written, is that he made the agreement with them that they could continue taking people for experimental purposes in exchange for technology which was being given to the United States. Whether he knew at that time or not that the same material was being given to the Russians, I don't know. Now, because I don't know exactly what Eisenhower did or didn't do, but I do know from personal knowledge that at the same time that the Americans were receiving technology, this was throughout the Cold War period after World War II, the same time as the Americans were receiving the technology, the Russians were receiving the same technology from the same extraterrestrials who were landing in Siberia, going to the secret city in Siberia, which still exists today, and sharing their technology with the Russians. And at the time that this was going on, I still lived in England. I was still a young woman, and I lived in England. And my off-planet friends came to me one day. We were receiving in England instructions from the government in case of nuclear war. And they came to me, my ET friends came to me one day and said, don't you ever worry about nuclear war. There will never be a nuclear war during this period between Russia and America, because both Russia and America now know they are both receiving the same technology, and neither one of them can beat the other.
All right,
and that was told to me in the 1960s, around 1960.
Right. Here's Eisenhower's warning.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Now, basically, as he has, as he continued to set up MJ-12 or support them, if the Dulles Boys, if you will, and that history, people can, they shut him out, and he lost control of the secret government, the black. Okay, let's talk about that a minute.
Well, I would say that basically Eisenhower was a good guy. He was one of the white hats. He was a good man, a good man. And that sense of goodness is something that is sadly lacking in most of the leadership since that time. I would say the last one, you don't have to agree with their politics or their way of thinking. We all know that some people are good. And when we say that's a good man, we mean it's a kind person who has good intentions for everyone around him, good intent in everything he does. And we've had one or two. I think one who was another good man historically was Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was in absolute shock when they disclosed to him that the UFOs were real. Apparently, when you become president, you get a meeting with the head of the NSA or the secret whatever, the CIA, FBI, the top secret people. You get a meeting the day you're inaugurated, and they tell you somewhat of the truth about the extraterrestrials, but they don't tell you all of the truth. And one of the things that John Kennedy was trying to do was to make them tell him all the truth. And indeed, there is a school of thought which says that his demand for the truth about the extraterrestrials was one of the reasons why he was killed. So, you know, that's just a school of thought. Whether it's true or not, I have no way of knowing. But it is interesting that even the President of the United States does not get the whole truth about what's going on with the extraterrestrials and the military space programs, which do exist, and for which Michael Sala has managed to dig up a variety of documentary evidence proving his case. that these right. things are in existence, like,
okay.
you know, Solar Warden.
Absolutely. Well, here's Kennedy.
And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. This administration intends to be candid about its errors, for as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment.
Now, that's the statement that you were referring to, that he was shut out of the
yeah.
information. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, it's true. He was. He was closed out from it. They wouldn't disclose it to him. And that's
okay.
not right. It's
right.
It should frighten every... We think we have freedom, right? When our elected, our most senior elected official does not know and is not privy to the single most important secrets held by our military, then we have no freedom. We're actually controlled by the military.
Right, 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 right. Especially the dark forces of the military. Solar
right.
Warden
right.
that Corey Good talks about. Now,
right.
Reagan did mention in his departure that he knew a little bit about the aliens, that they were here. And before the UN... He made a statement, and it goes like so.
In our obsession with antagonisms of the moment, we often forget how much unites all the members of humanity.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
Does that
and yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Okay, all right. But does that lead to war with aliens, if you will? That statement.
No, I think, if you want just my opinion, right, because
yeah.
obviously I have no direct knowledge of Reagan or what he was doing, right? But
okay.
if you want my opinion, I always thought that that speech was a bit of clever politicking. On his part, I thought that he knew something of the presence of extraterrestrials, and that he made that speech in the UN because he was very keen on his Star Wars program getting approval in the Security Council. I just thought it was a very, very clever speech on the behalf that he made. suggesting that we could need to be at war with extraterrestrials, and therefore, you know, we needed all this, whatever it was he was wanting.
But
I don't think he believed his. I think that's the one time when he didn't believe what he was saying.
Okay,
he really was.
Didn't Trump
up.
Fulfill that promise, that mandate, if you will?
Yes, he did. But
okay.
We're in a different time now. We're not in Reagan's time anymore.
We're
right. In a different time in history. And the danger is from within a whole lot more than it's from without.
All right.
And I think that that which is within at the moment is probably highly influenced by the extraterrestrial influence that the Germans are working with in Antarctica, which is
okay.
A reptilian influence.
Okay.
So we're in danger, as always, from the reptilians. And I can say this to my certain knowledge, that the Anunnaki have been fighting the reptilians in space warfare for several thousand years.
All right. Well, listen, it's so much material. And for those individuals who want to catch up with some of this, I'm suggesting watch Gaia, Cosmic Connections, Beyond Belief with George Norrie, or even go to the Discovery Channels and watch Stephen Greer, founder of the Discovery Project, and watch Unacknowledged. Have you seen Unacknowledged?
No, I haven't, but I do know Dr. Greer, and he's a brilliant man. Well worth it. He's got stuff out there. It's almost certainly worth watching. Read Dr. Michael Sala, read Zachariah Sitchin, watch Dr. Greer, and do look up that biblical program on history called Noah. It's
okay.
In four parts, because
right.
That, for people who place a lot of trust in the Bible, that is a very informative and well worth watching program. It gives a huge amount of
spell
information.
That.
Noah,
spell that for
N-O-A-H, it's the biblical Noah.
Oh.
You know, Noah
yes.
In the Bible.
Yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Well, that's the,
yes.
That's the program. That's
so
what the program's called.
Okay,
and it's
Noah.
In four segments. Yeah,
on,
Noah.
On what was
on
it?
History
net,
Channel.
With the History Channel.
History.
Okay, great.
History
okay,
Channel.
Great.
Yes.
Good.
It's
I will watch.
Well,
that.
Worth what it's worth watching for anybody, because it tells you, it has a great deal of knowledge in it, a great deal of information that's worth having, especially in this time in history, because it relates to now.
Okay.
It tells you out of the Bible what relates to now.
Yep. Steven Spielberg did a 13-hour television series some years ago called Taken. Have you watched any of that?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And it was a very interesting. I actually have it on disc. I got the disc of it.
I do too.
It's a good.
I do too.
It's a good story. In fact, I might watch it again. I haven't watched it for a long time.
Yeah, 13 hours.
It's a good story. Yeah.
Yeah. And people can go to Amazon.com and get it. It's there on Amazon. I think it was selling for $69 the last time I saw it. But anyway, listen, there's so much to cover. Jesus. So you could go on hour after hour.
I guess there's some little thing, you know, that maybe is a helpful idea, that you need to be able to view things outside our time concept. In other words, don't package everything into times, and understand that religion and politics and the planet and extraterrestrials, you can't think about one without thinking about the other, because they are all interlocked. There's nothing separate from anything else. They're all many parts of the one whole. You don't have extraterrestrials without having terrestrial politics involved.
Okay.
You don't have terrestrial politics without economies involved. You don't have economies without nations and their personal interests involved. So everything is tied in with everything else. And then you have the threads that run through it, like the religious beliefs of all the different people.
True.
So there's nothing really separate from anything else. And that includes you personally. You as an individual, whoever you might be who listens to a conversation like this, you personally are part of this conversation. You are one of these beings who is, as we all are, who are participating in this. We are the body politic. We are the beings of the universe. And on any other planet, we are the extraterrestrials. So, it's just one big whole with millions of separate parts in it. And every part is linked some way to every other. So when you're thinking about it, let it all flow through your mind at once. Open up your mind and let the whole ocean of varied information flow in, and then start to recognize yourself, what you see as something true, and what you see as a question to ask yourself, and how your questions are answered by the whole.
Well, today is, yeah, of course, by all means. No, I'm with you. Today is July 12th, 2022, and you are saying that your sources, your contacts on the other side, David particularly, he has said that something is coming in August.
Yes, yes. I'm just thinking today, 1 month from now, I expect to be really recognizing something going on unique in this world that's going to change a lot of things.
Okay. All right. Well, I really appreciate you being here. We covered a lot. There's so much more to cover, and we will meet up next time to maybe get into some specificity of what Corey Good, David Wilcox, John Lear, and all the rest of those guys are saying out there in terms of the revelations that are coming to the fore. So thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. You covered a lot of territory.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
What books would, in addition to the ones that you have mentioned, what other material would you recommend for people to turn to catch up with?
For everybody who is really wants to understand how they progress as an individual, with all that we were talking about, you know, about soul progression and reincarnation things, if you really want a good book that's going to move you forward, it's that Saving Jesus by, what was that man's name?
I don't know, but Saving Jesus, my son was asking me about that book the other day. It is on Amazon, Saving Jesus.
Yes. And make sure you get the right one, because there's a title very similar to it. And it's a friend of mine got the similar title, and it's the wrong book.
Wow.
You have to make sure you get the right book.
Yeah, I have to.
So I'm having to ask you, I've forgotten the writer. Wit begins with a W. With something or other.
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, that book, Saving Jesus. I did order it the other day, though. I had it here.
Well,
but
it's a wonderful book, and it really does tell you how to make the kind of progression that you need to make in order to choose the best incarnation for yourself in the future. So it's a book very, very well worth studying.
Okay.
It's an interesting story as well. Okay, Ledwith, that's the author's name. Saving Jesus by Michael Ledwith, Ledwith. And the Michael has a foreign spelling. It's an Irish spelling, MICEAL.
EAL, okay, Michael Ledwith, Ledwith. Okay.
Yes.
Well,
so make sure you get the right book.
you've given us some homework to do. So the next time we do this, I want to get into that book a wee bit more, right? To just is the book, I think, is what, 400 or 500 pages? But anyway, to talk about...
At least.
Okay, to talk
but
about...
It's a wonderful book.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd be glad to share information about that book because I've read it 3 times now, so I think I have an understanding of what it's saying. I'd be happy to discuss it with you.
Well, for those of us who don't read 400, 500, or 600 pages at a sitting, then we need your help on this one. So next time we will talk about Saving Jesus by Michael Ledwith. How's that?
Right. Yes.
All right.
Very
thank
happy
you for,
to do it. Thank you for having me. Bye now.
Well, okay, bye now. You take care. Have a good one. Thank you very much. Thank you.